Welcome to episode 3 of the Precinct Omega Weekly Miniatures News Podcast. It's the 14th of May as I record this, and here is the news.
The news.
Heresy Lab are running a Kickstarter for grimdark sci-fi power armour and associated vehicles. This is very much a campaign for people who think that what 40k really needs is even more skulls and gothic twiddly bits. Their campaign is nearly at an end, so look for Heresy Labs on Kickstarter now if you're interested. Meanwhile, Wormwood Gaming has also running a Kickstarter, but this time for something a bit different. It's for dice. Their dice come in a range of gemstone, resin, glass, and wood ranges, and I have to say, they do look pretty. Modular Realms are also on Kickstarter, and they're making magnetic dungeon tiles. These are dungeon tiles that connect easily with magnets, can be taken apart and redesigned for different dungeons. Very much with a fantasy bent at the moment, but who knows where they may take designs in the future if they're successful. Look for Modular Realms on Kickstarter. And lastly, Sustainable Wargaming sadly has failed to raise the $16,000 they were looking for on Kickstarter for their plant-based sustainable dice. Can you guess what the subject of today's discussion is going to be?
The discussion.
So yes, today we are definitely talking about Kickstarter. Kickstarter has absolutely transformed the landscape of games development. I think it is fair to say there are now hundreds, possibly even thousands of games and gaming products that have come to market through the medium of Kickstarter. Now, inevitably that does raise a question, to my mind, of how many of those products would have made it to market if there hadn't been the platform of Kickstarter to get behind them and to give them the funding they needed to exist. So I wanted to take our discussion in a direction today that has a look at the way that products get funding to find their way into market, how Kickstarter has changed that, whether that's going to be a good thing in general. And responding to feedback from my patrons, thank you very much, I will talk at the end about the significance of this week's discussion on Precinct Omega itself. So first of all, let's have a think about the historical ways in which businesses found funding to get off the ground. The obvious starting place for most businesses historically was simply private wealth. Most private wealth came out of land ownership or mercantilism, and that generated a lot of surplus capital that could be put back into businesses to create new products and services. That said, in these days, the problem with land wealth was that it didn't generate a lot of capital very quickly. So if you invested on a large scale in a new endeavour, it meant that it could drain capital out of the land management system for sometimes generations to come. And that meant that private wealth was often very slow at moving out of the hands of those who had accumulated the wealth and into the hands of those who could put it to work generating new products and services. Now that's a really, really trimmed down version of pre-industrial investment. But it's, I think, a good starting point. Following the industrialization, we saw a great deal more private wealth being generated quicker, which meant that it could flow out faster. And of course, at the same time, we saw the development and evolution of the banking system, the arrival of paper money, and the establishment of a more reputable position in the world for bank loans. Even so, it was still difficult for individual entrepreneurs to gain access to money, partly because entrepreneurship wasn't encouraged for the most part by those who already had access to money. And the banks themselves, as historically always have done, what's the saying goes, that you only loan money to people who can prove they don't need to borrow it. It was always a challenge for any small enterprise or any aspiring developer, inventor, innovator to find the money to invest in developing their product to bring it to market. And a lot of innovation was slowed as a result of that. You only need to look at the histories of people like Alexander Graham Bell or Thomas Edison or his great rival Nikola Tesla to see that these people spent a huge amount of their time not actually inventing or innovating, but trying to find people to invest, to give them enough money that they could actually bring their innovations and technology to market. And it's interesting to think back now and to wonder what innovations didn't come to market or might have come to market had these people been able to access the kind of funding they needed more easily. The other source of funding for the entrepreneur before the modern age was, of course, through the government. So the government would invest money through a range of different means. Primarily, they liked to do it through tax breaks, but also if you could demonstrate the value of a product to a government, then potentially you could gain direct backing. But let's be honest, this was even harder than getting private investment. And tax breaks are great, don't get me wrong, but if you haven't already got the money that means that the tax break makes a difference, then the government offering you tax breaks for innovation isn't actually really helping you bring anything new to market. And so we come to the 21st century and the arrival of the crowdfunding model. I think future students of economics are going to find this an interesting topic of study. And I genuinely at this point don't know what they're going to be looking at. Are they going to be looking at the brief rise of crowdfunding before its inevitable collapse? Are they going to look at how crowdfunding originally funded amazing new technological investments and then gradually drifted away towards trivia and entertainment? Are they going to be looking at how crowdfunding transformed the model of investment for new business and technology? Now, I hope it's going to be that last one. The crowdfunding originally got its start as a means of funding social enterprise. That is, you might have a neighbourhood or a small community that wanted something new, and the first crowdfunding platforms were set up for members of that community to commit money to go towards funding things that the community needed that government, for whatever reason, wasn't going to pay for. That was the early origin of crowdfunding, but it very quickly grew out of that into a private enterprise model. And the obvious exemplar poster child and almost monopoly holder in this field is Kickstarter. So Kickstarter, I imagine if you're listening to this podcast, you've come across it. But if you haven't, let me give you a very quick summary of how it works. The idea is that somebody has a project. They create a page on Kickstarter for that project. They say what that project is going to create, how they're going to create it, and how much money they need in order to make that project a reality. People can then commit varying different levels of money to that project. And if the project raises enough money, it will then go into action and the project will be delivered. What has happened is that, well, from the start, part of the idea was that the project owners would offer rewards to their backers. And this is really interesting because, of course, I kind of need to wind back a little bit because I've missed over a point, but it's good to bring it back here. The other source of private investment funding, rather than finding a single sugar daddy who would put all of the money in to make something work, was what's called the sale of stock. So the project owner, in the pre-Kickstarter, pre-21st century days, the project owner would found a company. They would break that company up into an amount of stock. So let's say they create 100 holdings in that company, and each part was worth so much money. They would sell that stock then to people to raise funds to run the company. Well, not to run the company, because the company ought to be making money, but at least to fund a project or an expansion or an adventure that was going to make a lot more money. And people would do that on the basis of two things. First, the idea was that a stockholder would receive a dividend on the basis of whatever project the company was undertaking. So if the company makes vast sums of money, they would receive a percentage of those profits based on the amount of stock that they held. The other way that they made money was to sell the stock. So the idea was that if the company expected to make a lot of profit, therefore it would be paying a large dividend, therefore people would want to own the stock, therefore they could buy it from people who already owned it in order to gain the dividend. The idea being that the person who owned it would sell that stock for more than they initially bought it, thus making a profit. That was a way that businesses raised money. But to do so was very complicated and time-consuming. For a small business, especially for a sole trader, the sale of stock simply wasn't a feasible way of raising money. Kickstarter and its ilk come into this market as a way of distributing the risk upon an interested investment group in return for rewards. Those rewards are not conventional stock. So you're not buying stock in a company through Kickstarter. There's nothing you can officially own and sell on as a part of that company. But what you do earn are rewards that the project owner decides that they are going to give out. Now, the obvious example is, I am going to produce this product. This product will cost me, say, $10,000 to produce in the quantities that I want. If you back me for, say, $10, you will get one of these products, because they cost, let's say they're going to cost at retail $15. If you back now, you'll get it for $10. And hopefully it costs me $5 to make. So I'm making a reduced profit by selling it early to my backers. Now, I say selling, it's important actually that Kickstarter's model is not officially a pre-sale model. So people aren't buying products from me, they are investing in the project. So if the project fails to raise enough money, well, first of all, if the project doesn't raise enough money, it doesn't go ahead. Now, there are actually some changes that mean it can now in Kickstarter terms, but originally that was the whole idea. If it doesn't have enough money, it doesn't go ahead, full stop, nice and simple. But rather than, sorry, I've lost my place because I had to check my recording. The project doesn't go ahead. If it does raise enough money, in theory, the project goes ahead. But in practice, once you've committed your money through Kickstarter, Kickstarter themselves are not obliged to deliver that product. The project owner themselves are not legally obliged to deliver that product. You are an investor, and you are hoping to get a return on your investment in the form of early access or a discounted version of this product. A lot of confusion and hurt and damage has been done to the gaming community, particularly through Kickstarter, through projects that were funded, sometimes overfunded, sometimes massively funded, but where the project owner has failed to deliver, either because life has simply overwhelmed them and they haven't been able to do it, or because they massively underestimated the costs that it was going to cost to deliver. So even if they raised $1 million, if it was going to cost $1.5 million to create the product and deliver it to all of its buyers, they simply couldn't cover the additional costs. Or they were just crooks, and they raised the money, took it and ran, and there's very little comeback for the backers. Despite that risk, Kickstarter has been hugely popular, hugely successful. And there are multiple products in our world, in the gaming world, that have generated well over $1 million of funding raised through Kickstarter. Now, it should be said that does not mean well over $1 million of revenue, because it's easy to lose money on Kickstarter, but that's the model. Now, there is an important rider on all of this, and that is that Kickstarter itself is not a social enterprise. It makes money. In fact, it is a highly profitable business. It takes 10% of the funding of every successful campaign. So you need to bear that in mind. If you're backing on Kickstarter, 10% of everything you're committing goes straight into the pocket of the platform itself. So having given you the background of Kickstarter, the discussion in its meat is this good or is this bad? Is Kickstarter something that people should be supporting or is it not? Well, to an extent, I like it. It is, in fact, I like it a lot in this respect. It is a democratization, as I said, of the funding process. It takes the process of funding new products out of the hands of a financial elite that can dictate what does and what does not deserve to be turned into a product or service. And that's the sort of the dragon's den kind of model of funding, which is a vast simplification and an insult to real capital investors, but they are a tiny, tiny proportion. They are a 1% of the 1% that can afford to be investors of this kind of thing. And really putting it back into the hands of the developers and of the people who have a passion for the product they're developing is, in my opinion, an excellent thing. As I say, it is a democratization of the process. It also is a sound distribution of risk. One of the things about the sale of stock, selling shares in a company, is that you distribute the risk so that, yes, if the company does well, the shareholders gain the benefit, but equally, if the company does poorly, the shareholders carry the risk. The share price will slip, they will lose money, it will be their job to find the money to go back into it. And there's a whole political thing about this, particularly off the banks, where companies that are deemed too big to fail end up not being carried by their investors, but by the government. But rather than going down that particular alleyway, this does distribute the risk in a way that is broadly fair. In principle, nobody should be backing anything on Kickstarter that they can't afford. If they can afford the product, they can afford to lose the money. So, in principle, it is a fair distribution of risk. A lot of the risk lies with the project owner, of course, but they offset the risk by gaining funding from the people who invest. And Kickstarter, let me emphasize, is very much an investment model. However, there is a problem between the gap between what Kickstarter set out to be, what it was at the beginning, and what it has as a result become. And I think actually I can illustrate part of that problem through talking about the third part of this, which is how Precinct Omega is going to be how Precinct Omega may be involved in Kickstarter or may not be involved in Kickstarter. But before I talk about Precinct Omega, I should say that there are some problems. First of all, I said it is not a pre-order system. And yet in practice, for many products, it has become that, where you have companies that have already ploughed tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars into a new product. They know they're going to release that product. They know that product is going to sell, and yet they put it up on Kickstarter. Not because they need the money, but because Kickstarter has become a marketing vehicle by which they can generate interest and create a community behind a product before it is released, which is obviously good for the sustainability of a product. Plus, it puts a huge chunk of cash in the developer's hands up front to offset some of the development costs. But what that results in is pushing out of the market the people for whom Kickstarter was originally designed. Companies that have got tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars to invest in a product do not need to be on Kickstarter. They could be releasing that company with a marketing budget of their own that doesn't need to be funded by their backers. Instead, they are taking away attention and they're taking away investment opportunities from small companies or sole traders or innovators who could do vastly more and more constructively with those investors' money than these big companies. The counter-argument to that, of course, is that no, they aren't, because these innovators wouldn't be getting that money anyway. The people who are backing these high-profile big company campaigns are established backers of those companies. They are early adopters of those companies' products anyway. So realistically, it's not that other innovators are losing that money, it's just additional money that's being pumped into Kickstarter. And the 10% slice that Kickstarter takes is effectively the marketing budget for the campaign. Boom. So, that's Kickstarter. Is Kickstarter good? Is Kickstarter bad? Overall, Kickstarter has been an excellent thing for the wargaming market in that it has put, as I say, hundreds, possibly thousands of new products and services into the market that would not otherwise have existed. However, it has its negatives. One of its negatives is for the investor. There is, as I say, no guarantee that you are going to get the reward that you have paid for. And inevitably, there are going to be some investors who can't afford it, who have overcommitted their money, who were hoping at the end of a product to be able to sell on whatever they have backed in order to cover the costs that they have lost by backing a product that they couldn't really afford to, either because the timing is bad or because they were taken away by their own enthusiasm. So that's a problem. Far more important is the problem for the project managers themselves, in my opinion. First of all, a lot of project managers are very new to business. They're innovators, they've got great ideas, they've got great designs, but they don't really understand how to calculate the costs of getting their product to market. As a result, when they have a successful campaign and become obligated to deliver on the rewards that they have promised, morally, if not legally, all of a sudden they find that they can't actually deliver without spending more money, sometimes vast amounts more money than they can actually afford. Plus, they've got an obligation. Life throws some weird stuff. If you're just a sole trader or a tiny team of people and something comes up that you weren't expecting and all of a sudden you've got a multi-tens of thousands of dollars of product to deliver, and you just can't do it anymore. It can mean that your reputation is ruined, that your company folds, you may be bankrupt. You certainly are not going to be popular with the people who backed you for rewards that they're not getting. And guess what? It's going to be really hard to get another project off the ground when that's happened to you once. Even harder in those rare cases where people have come back and it's happened to them twice. The third problem with Kickstarter that I see is that whilst, yes, it has put thousands of new innovative products into the market, it's also created a glut of one-off products that were funded and delivered but never followed up on. We've got a lot of new games, new products out there on the, not just the war games market, but all over the world that have come out of Kickstarter. And the project leader has broken themselves delivering that project either successfully or partially or unsuccessfully, and there's no follow-up. All the momentum is wasted on delivering on a product that ultimately either didn't satisfy, didn't meet needs, or wasn't up to the standard that people wanted, and there's nothing left over to drive that potential forward. So those are the issues I see with Kickstarter. Is there anything else I'd like to discuss on the subject of Kickstarter before we talk about Precinct Omega? No, I guess just to summarise that I think it's... overall, I think Kickstarter is a good concept. It has been increasingly, I would think, abused a little recently. But overall, I think it still stays more or less true to its original vision. Oh, there is one other thing I should pick up on Kickstarter. Kickstarter does not treat its own employees very well. Just need to put that out there. There have been substantial disputes between management and employees to the point that Kickstarter employees wanted to unionise. I say they wanted to, it's not like a collective, everybody wanted to unionise, but there was certainly a core group of employees within Kickstarter that were dissatisfied enough that they wished to unionise. Unionisation in the United States can be quite difficult for a range of reasons, and certainly employers have got a lot more power to influence that sort of thing, and a lot of Kickstarter employees either lost their jobs or suffered substantial intimidation behaviour at the hands of the leadership of Kickstarter in the pursuit of this unionisation approach. Now, that disappoints me on a number of levels. You can make it a matter of ethics, morality, if you like. From my perspective, I see it primarily as a failure of business strategy, that unions have an enormous amount to offer employers, from my experience, and that a positive relationship with a union can really help to build and grow a company and to grow engagement between the company and its employees in a way that I think many companies underestimate. And I certainly think Kickstarter themselves underestimated the value that working with a union could have provided to their company. So I think it's a failure of strategic leadership on their part. Whether it shows a lack of morals or poor ethics on their part is a very subjective issue and not one that I want to go into. Broadly speaking, though, I still consider Kickstarter to be a good thing, both for the community of wargamers and for the world in general, because I believe the democratisation of investment is an overall positive thing.
Precinct Omega.
Precinct Omega has not yet run a Kickstarter. I've backed several as an individual. The reason I decided not to take Zero Dark to Kickstarter was twofold. The first was really a philosophical thing. I believe the business should stand or fall on its own merits. Whilst a project may be something you can take to Kickstarter, if nothing else, to judge whether there is the community support for something, I don't think the establishment of a business in its own right ought to be a Kickstarter matter. Zero Dark, for me, really represented a launch for Precinct Omega. And I did not want the existence of my company to rely upon the success or otherwise of Kickstarter to place it into the hands of my investors. I thought it should be my decision how much things cost, when they were delivered, and the form in which they were delivered. It's my business. But I could have done it on Kickstarter, and there are some practical reasons why I decided not to. The first practical reason why I decided not to is that in the games and war games market on Kickstarter, there is a massive signal to noise issue. The ratio of noise to signal is very badly distorted towards the noise, and I mean, there are hundreds of gaming products on the market right now, and I was afraid that Zero Dark would simply get lost, that not enough people would see it, so it would fall between the cracks, unless I was prepared to invest heavily into the marketing of it. And frankly, if I had the money to invest heavily into the marketing of my game, I felt at that point that I should be investing that back into the quality of the game itself. The second issue was that had I run on Kickstarter, well, basically, I would already have had a finished product. You know, I would have had a finished set of rules for Kickstarter before I began the campaign. So the purpose of the Kickstarter would have been to pay for the art direction of Zero Dark to basically to pay for me to commission more art to go into the book. I would have loved to have put more art in. I got one painted piece from David Sondra that's wonderful. I'm going to get another one for Operation Nemesis. But if I had wanted to commission David to produce 6 or 7 pieces of art, and I wanted to produce another artist to produce, say, another dozen pieces of art, smaller pieces of art to illustrate the book, to make it a really widely illustrated piece of work, then, I mean, I would have been looking to raise thousands of dollars, none of which would actually have contributed to making the game one jot better. It would have just been making the book prettier, and yet it would have caused a massive delay on the release, because you would have to wait weeks, if not months, for the artist to finish all of the paintings that were commissioned. I'd then have to get those properly formatted and embedded into the manuscript, and the whole manuscript would have had to be rejigged around the art. So there would have introduced there an enormous delay between the end of the Kickstarter and the release of the product. And, I mean, I just functionally didn't want to delay the release. Once I had a ready product, I wanted to get it out there as quickly as possible. So that's why one piece of art, photography by me, miniatures by me, layout by me, editing, formatting, everything by me, doesn't need a penny of Kickstarter money. I paid out of my pocket for David to do the painting, and everybody gets a product sooner. Why introduce an unnecessary delay in the release of a product and put it on Kickstarter? So that's one of the things in my mind. And of course, that worked to my benefit, because not going on Kickstarter meant that I released just at the beginning of lockdown, which turned out to be a great time to be releasing a game with a strong solo component. That said, the last and most important reason that I didn't launch on Kickstarter was simply the scale of the upfront costs. Now, I know that it is possible to create a Kickstarter campaign, launch it, and fund it in very little time and with very little money. I know, because I got friends and acquaintances who have done it. But I was talking about something that was effectively going to be launching my company, that was going to be making a statement about what Precinct Omega was and what it aspired to be. And I couldn't afford that to be a half-hearted effort. That would have meant upfront costs, both on art and on making videos and on making supporting graphics to go with the whole stretch goals things. And I know those are not required. They are not a prerequisite of running on Kickstarter. You can run Kickstarters on very simple basic graphics and very simple templates. But once you do that, you're making a statement about the kind of company that you are on Kickstarter. And I didn't want to be that kind of company. By the same measure, I didn't want to be kickstarting something that didn't need to be kickstarted. A game, ultimately, it was a finished product. It could go out there without a jot of art, without any fancy layout, and it would still be the same fundamental product, the same game. So for all of those reasons, I did not go into Kickstarter with Zero Dark. But I would like to go back to Kickstarter, or at least some crowdfunding form, in the future. I already, of course, have Patreon, which is crowdfunding in a different way. And if you like this podcast and you're not already a patron, I would really appreciate your support at patreon.com/precinctomega. All of my patrons contribute so hugely to the work that I do, not just with their money, but with their feedback and their comments and the support that they give me. But I would like to go to Kickstarter with a product, maybe later this year, maybe early 2021. Reason being that Zero Dark is built on a mechanics. One of the core mechanics in Zero Dark is the use of playing cards as an artificial intelligence system to operate the Red Force, which is the unaligned third party in a two-player game, or it's your enemy if you're playing a single-player co-op game. And the Red Force is controlled by a deck of playing cards. I would love, truly love, to be able to produce a Zero Dark playing cards deck themed to Zero Dark. Beautiful art, well laid out, brand new designs, plus a load of additional cards to act as aid memoirs and extra mechanics for the game. I've got some great ideas for it. I'd love to produce it. It's a hell of a lot of money. I think later this year I may be in the position that I will have enough capital that I can commission some sample pieces of artwork. I can line up some artists. I can do the designs for the cards myself and design what's going to be on them and do the briefs. And that would be worth taking to Kickstarter. I think I could do Kickstarter justice. I think I could do the product justice. And it is a discrete project. It's a product that couldn't exist without substantial capital, which I don't have, which Kickstarter could provide for me. I think there might be enough of a market to make it worthwhile, even for those that perhaps aren't interested in Zero Dark, that just love cool sets of playing cards. And I think it could be a product that has a life after Kickstarter. And that is one of the things that annoys me, is when you get a Kickstarter thing like sorry, Corvus Belli, going to call you out, Infinity Defiance, doing a project that's Kickstarter only. If you don't back it on Kickstarter, you don't get it. That seems wrong to me. It's called Kickstarter. The whole idea is that it is supposed to start something. And it's a real frustration to me when something is Kickstarter only. I want a product that is kickstarted by my Kickstarter backers' investments, so that there is a product going forwards for other people to buy. Because that seems to me right and proper to the philosophy of what crowdfunding is supposed to be. Okay, I have talked enough. I have done now 3 episodes of this. I'm going to do 1 more episode of this podcast next week. After that, I would love to have one of my listeners come back and have their own say on one of the subjects or topics that I've talked about in these discussion sections. So obviously the first episode is a bit of a write-off on that. Second episode was about borrowing other people's aesthetics, other companies' aesthetics for your products. This one was about Kickstarter. Next week is going to be quite controversial, I hope, because I've got a good one to talk about, assuming I've got some good news products to go with it. And if you are interested in appearing on the podcast, it won't involve an interview or anything. It's just you recording 15 minutes of your thoughts on a particular product. And I would love to get 2, maybe even 3 of my listeners to submit their thoughts on any of the subjects that I have covered across in the last, it will be 3 weeks by the time we get to it. Record it up to 15 minutes. Send it to me at precinctomega@gmail.com. And those that I like the best, I will feature in an episode number 5. Right? Thank you for listening, and I will speak to you next week.
The Precinct Omega Weekly Miniatures News Podcast is supported by our patrons on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/precinctomega to support the Patreon, developing new miniatures games and creating hobby content for Wargames miniatures enthusiasts all over the world.